Welcome to the Manx Theatre Podcast.
Come on to the theatre.
Hello, and welcome back to episode 49 of the Manx Theatre Podcast with me, Neil Callan. Thank you to everyone who's listened to our previous episodes. If you're brand new to the podcast, welcome along and thanks for joining us. In this podcast, we like to try and keep you up to date with what's going on in theatre on the Isle of Man, chatting to the cast and creatives of upcoming shows to find out a little bit more about the shows and the people behind them, and also what our Manx-born and bred performers are doing further afield.
Coming up on this week's podcast,
I'm joined by Sharon and John Walker from the Service Players, ahead of their upcoming production of Agatha Christie's Witness for the Prosecution. You can still listen to all of our previous episodes through all the usual podcast outlets and at manxradio.com/podcasts. Whilst you're there, make sure to give us a click and like and subscribe or follow or whatever it is you need to do to make sure you never miss an episode. Now, since the last episode, I had the opportunity to have a couple of days in London for work and found myself with a free evening all to myself. So clearly, I had to go and see a show, but which one? There's lots of Manxies in London shows at the moment, but in the end, I chose to buy an immersive ticket for Guys and Dolls at the Bridge Theatre, featuring our very own Perry O'Dea as Angie the Ox. Wow. What a show. As anyone who's seen me since I've been to see the show, I just can't stop raving about it. The show is played in the round, with three levels of audience all around, and if you get an immersive ticket, like I did, you'll find yourself in the heart of the action. At the start of the show, the set is a flat floor marked out as a street, with yellow lines, road markings, street signs hanging above your head, and the constant rumble of traffic and subway cars passing by. There's hot dogs, beer, big dough pretzels for sale, along with hats and all sorts of other merch. The stage crew are all dressed as New York cops, and as the show goes on, they usher you in and out as various pieces of the flooring rise and form to fill the stage for various scenes. Marisha Wallace, playing Adelaide, is surely to be a big name of the future. She gives an amazing performance with heart and brass and none of that little cutesy, oh my god. Nicely Johnson has always been a bucket list role for me, and I got to see Cedric Neil play him in this production. Well, for the first half anyway, as due to illness, his cover had to take over for the second half. And his rendition of Sit Down, You're Rockin' the Boat had the place screaming like it was a Taylor Swift concert. After seeing this production and the hilarious performance by Owen Arthur, Nathan Detroit has now firmly been added to that list of parts that I need to play. Now, I could go on about this show for ages and probably fill an entire podcast just talking about the staging and the set and the experience, but the best thing I can do is suggest if you find yourself in London with a free night, do yourself an enormous favour, get an immersive ticket and go along and see it. You will not regret it. On the local scene, the sun shone on Parados Theatre Company's Merchant of Venice at the Villa Marina Gardens, which saw all four shows sell out before it had even opened. A reflection of the guys probably could have released more tickets had they known how good the weather was going to be, but they had to limit it to the number they could safely fit in the villa's promenade suite, which was their fallback for bad weather. They used the raised area by the centre steps leading up to the top of the colonnade, which gave them lots of different levels to work with, along with several cast members working their way through the gardens and audience on foot, and even made an entrance on an ice cream bike. This is a great venue for these kind of productions, and will hopefully be used a lot more in the future. Then we had the Manx Last Night of the Proms at the Gaiety on the 23rd of September, which Damien Neal stepped into the fray, replacing Paul Costain, who was injured or unwell at the very last minute. Well done, Damo, for stepping in there. Then, in October, we had a week of Joseph and the Amazing Technical Dreamcoat from the Christine Wilde Theatre School and Rachel Wilde Performer Studio at the Gaiety Theatre. Then, in just the last couple of weeks, we've seen performances of Educating Rita on the 13th and 14th of October at the Peel Centenary Centre, and then the 26th and 27th at the Aeronauts Centre in Port Erin. I mean, if I get this out in time and you manage to listen to it in time, you might still be able to make those last two performances at the Aeronauts Centre. Now, Educating Rita is directed and produced by Lindsay Quayle and stars Kim Quine as Rita and Jack Verity as the Professor. In recent weeks, Two Feathers have carried out auditions for their July 2024 production of Jersey Boys, which tells the story of the career and rise to fame of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. They are keeping the casting in a similar style to the London show, with a cast of just 18. The lead roles are being played by Joe Hillard as Frankie Valli, Charlie Williams, Tommy DeVito, Jack Divers as Bob Gordio, and Ian Dixon as Nick Massey. Peter Shimmin will be playing Joe Pesci and also is the cover for Frankie Valli. The rest of the roles will be played by the members of the company, who will be doubling and even tripling up on roles. The company is made up of Nick Kane, Mark Doherty, Catherine Toohey, Jordan McCormack, Grace Hoodless, Dandy Dancox, Eve Pizarre, Andrew Dayton, Lisa Dancox, Beth Thomas, Molly Bowman, Zach Colgan, and myself. The show is being co-directed by superstar duo Tara Overfield-Wilkinson and Mark Hilton. Well, over the next 7 or 8 weeks, we're going to see Samantha Barks on our TV on ITV1 every Sunday evening, as she's a judge on the new Mamma Mia! I Have a Dream programme, which is a talent show looking to find unknown musical theatre stars to play Sophie and Skye for the West End production of Mamma Mia! Also, hot off the press, Sam has announced the birth of her baby. Raphael Richard Barkstall was born on the 16th of October. So we send huge congratulations to Sam and her husband Alex. Now, make sure you keep up to date with what's going on between episodes by following Manx Theatre Podcast on both Facebook and Instagram, and at Manx Theatre Pod on X, formerly Twitter, and Threads. Right, down to business. I'm joined in the studio today by director Sharon Walker and her husband and performer John Walker, ahead of the Service Players' upcoming production of A Witness for the Prosecution. Sharon, John, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having us on.
No problem. So, we're here today to talk about the Service Players production of A Witness for the Prosecution. Tell us about the story. What can we expect to see?
Classic Agatha Christie, which is originally staged in London in 1954. It's seen as one of her greatest stage shows. This is The Mousetrap, which has been running for a long time, and mm-hmm. which we have performed, Park and Snell did many years ago, but this is obviously the Service Players doing, which I think is actually the better production, Witness for the Prosecution, which starts off, as you might see, there's a fantastic video which we've done up in the Regency. So it starts off with a man appears in a barrister's office accompanied by his solicitor, saying that he's going to be arrested for murder. This woman called Miss Emily French. Leonard Vole appears with Mr. Mayhew, and he turns up to Sir Wilfred Roberts, as I term it, Chambers.
Yeah.
And it goes from there. So it starts off explaining exactly what happened the night before, and then it goes into the court scene of, well, did he, didn't he do it?
And that's the real sort of crux of the play, really. It's very much a high court drama.
Mm-hmm.
As the name of the production suggests, a lot of this is focused around the witnesses presenting their evidence for and against the...
Well, it's for against the case. It's an amazing production, and particularly the way that Sharon's done it, is it's trying to... Because one of the things one of the issues that you have with murder mysteries is sometimes they're very wordy,
yeah,
and you don't really get much of an audience interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ways that we're trying to do it is get the audience as involved as possible. So, for example, what in bits we're going to have, we've been offering VIP tickets. If people want to pay a little bit more, you can actually sit on the stage.
Wow.
Be part of the jury, so you'll go on.
Oh, great.
Swear that you're going to hear the evidence and give a fair judgment on what you think, whether they're guilty or not guilty. And
lovely.
Of course, no one's going to know until you're actually there.
Yeah, yeah.
We've got people coming in and out of the audience, that there's a screaming come down, mixed media playing the video at the beginning. So you actually see, so one of the things with the play is you don't see Miss French.
Yeah.
Obviously, she's been bumped off beforehand.
Yes.
But in our production, we're trying to bring her to life, because a lot of the best ways, and we see it, particularly when there was Inspector Calls, there's a BBC production a few years ago.
Yeah.
Amazing. If you haven't seen, amazing production, Inspector Calls. And you see everything that happens to her throughout the thing. It's awful, the things that goes through. But with this, you actually see Miss Emily French,
yeah,
and interaction with Leonard Vole, played by Dan. It's brilliant.
Dan Sebastian Gray.
Yes. So we filmed it up at the Regency. But there's so many little parts to it, but you get at a certain point, and within the space of about, I don't want to give too much away, but in the space of about 4 or 5 pages of the script, it could be about 5 or 6 different people.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's twisting and turning, and you think, there's that bit of evidence there that points to that person. Oh, no, there's that bit of evidence there, that bit of evidence there. And it sort of comes round and round and round, and eventually you get to the end. You go, wow, okay.
Yeah.
And then there's a fantastic plot twist all the way through, but also especially at the very end. It's very clever.
Yeah.
So we hope the audience will really love it. You know, in terms of people involved in the production, we have some fantastic long-serving members of the Service Players, like Lisa Smith and her husband Toby Smith, and Rachel Jochen and Rachel Martin. But we've also got some new people who are with us. So Dan Sebastian Gray, Rob James from Manx Radio, And so we've got some great people involved in the show, for sure.
And some bloke.
And some bloke. And some bloke.
Yeah, me.
Which part are you playing, John?
So I am playing Sir Wilfred Roberts, who's the counsel for the defence. So he's a very earnest man, and he's very diligent in what he wants to do, but he always wants to win.
Yes.
And by golly, he's going to win.
And that's why I cast him in the role, because he's perfect at the accent.
So it's a great role. Definitely one to get your teeth into, but it's one that not one for the faint-hearted.
Yeah,
I think it must be. You know, so a few years ago, Service Place did Dad's Army.
Yeah,
and Jeff doing Captain Mannering. That must have been. You don't realise it when you watch a TV programme like that, how much Mannering has. It must be 60%, 70% of the script. The lines are his. And it's similar to this, that Sir Wilfred is 60% of the lines.
Yeah.
Because he's in, and a lot of it's non-sequiturs come back and forth, and you've got to come up with the idea. But, no, there are certain points, particularly Rob is fantastic. He's amazing as Myers, as the prosecution
counsel. Yeah.
Great. And the way that he builds things up and moves around, the good thing with doing a murder mystery, and particularly drama, which we both really like doing, is you can create those moments.
Yeah.
And I've done it before when we've been on radio, where you just get that pause.
Yeah.
Just while you're waiting for the audience to catch up or something, just for the penny to drop. And there are certain moments in this as well, thankfully I've got a couple, where you say a line, something else comes off, and you just let it hang just for a moment to then come down. But now, everyone loves an Agatha Christie. The twists and turns. She is the queen of crime thrillers.
Yeah. So this was actually written way, way back in, 1925, I think it was? Yes, yeah.
The original script.
The original short story, yeah. That's all based on, yeah. So it was published in Flynn's, which was a weekly publication, on the 31st of January, 1925. So it's almost 100 years old.
There are certain bits we've had to review certain, because with a play like this, I think one of the problems when you're doing a play that's slightly older is that you can have audiences of the day in the 50s were a little bit more patient and would be willing to sit through. There's a few different versions of the scripts that we looked at, and the version that we've picked, Samuel French, Concord Theatricals, very kindly given us the rights to do it, is a little bit more audience friendly.
Yes.
So there are fewer enormous speeches, but it still retains that drive, and the film version. There's slight differences to the film version. So if people are familiar with the film,
there's been a couple of films actually, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a great one with Marlene Dietrich playing the wife.
Romaine, played by Lisa.
Yes, wife of Leonard Vohl, and she has this. The character is a foreign actress, and so she does that part particularly brilliantly. But there's a part later on where she has to have a Cockney accent, and she's absolutely awful at it.
But in a good way.
But in
Marlene Dietrich.
Marlene Dietrich being Cockney, right? Yeah, sorry,
we're not talking about
Lisa.
Way.
Lisa does it fantastically well, as Lisa always does, with the characters that she does. So I'm very lucky with the cast that I have, I think.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, so there's also been a number of television adaptations over the years as well, hasn't there?
Yes, the most recent one has Toby Jones.
And Kim Cattrall.
And Kim Cattrall in it. So interestingly enough, she plays Miss Emily French in that version as well. And as John says, you know, we see a really great big long backstory between her and Leonard Vohl before the murder actually happens. Whereas in the play, it starts after the murder has actually happened. So it is very different. But then again, the ending again in the TV version is different to the play. And obviously, we don't want to give the ending of the play away, but
yes, I believe there are a couple of different versions actually.
There
of
is,
the ending
it's
as well,
interesting
it will
as
not,
well.
I think it's safe to say that we have been asked whether we will be doing a different version every night.
Yes,
Well, you'll have to come and wait and see.
So you have to watch them all.
You have to come and buy a ticket every night and see. It might be different.
Because the members of the public who will be the jury will be asked to elect a foreman and they'll deliver the verdict.
Right.
So hopefully they will deliver the right one.
Well, if we do it right, they'll deliver the right one. Otherwise, we're going to have a... It could be interesting.
It will be a different ending if they deliver the wrong one, for sure.
Yeah. So just going back to the script there, you're saying there are different versions of the scripts, and obviously some things have been edited to be a bit more audience friendly. I guess with some of those things that are that old as well, and they're of a time, there's probably certain language or certain aspects of the scripts that possibly are, and we've had.
And you know, there are bits that, you know, certainly felt quite very, very sort of dated and not quite right.
Not quite PC these days.
No, absolutely. You know, the feminists among us perhaps felt that some of the language used towards...
There's a whole section where Robert, where Sir Wilfred and Mr. Mayhew, Toby, go off and complain about how their wives go on pick holidays.
Yeah.
And they just love looking at how, oh, if it was up to my wife's picked every house, she must have visited every house in Britain and deciding what she wants to
because
buy.
Because that's what they do all day with their time, apparently. Yeah. So
sit at home, knit, play with kittens and look at houses.
Indeed. So yes, there are certainly elements of it that we decided that
weren't essential to the story, let's put it that way.
Yeah. I mean, I've read the original Ian Fleming novels, and that's one of the things as well. They're talking about the same with Roald Dahl, aren't they? Sort of cleansing them and bringing them a bit up to date.
But there's a balance
to be had, I think, because there's a certain, you know, we've got it set in the 50s, even though it was written a bit earlier than that. And there's a certain context that you have to keep for having it within that setting. You can't modernise it too much. And I also think, you know, an Agatha Christie stands up very well in that particular period. It would be very difficult to modernise an Agatha Christie into sort of, you know, modern day crime and what have you, because a majority of the stories just wouldn't hold up in terms of forensic evidence and all of those sorts of things and what have you as well. You know, in this particular one, you know, there's a little bit of forensic evidence that is very sort of rudimentary, which would have literally just been walked straight through if it was sort of these times. So you have to think about when you're going to set it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then that helps in terms of how the mood that you put around the piece and what have you as well. So because we're setting it in the 50s, it will be slightly darker, almost sort of quite film noir type.
Mm-hmm. Nice suits then, John.
John actually has an acting suit.
Actor comes with own suit. Yes. I bought it for a play several years ago, and I think it must have been used in every single production. I'm hoping this time around I might get away with using a different suit.
Oh, I don't think so.
Well, we'll see. Well, come in to get book your ticket and find
just
out.
Just to see John's suit.
Just come and watch the suit. Yes.
probably got more time than I've had on stage.
Probably.
I have a coat stand that I think has done more service player productions than I have.
Oh, interesting, actually. Is it a wooden one?
It is, yes.
Yeah, we need to borrow it.
No problem, we'll get it out of the loft, yeah.
Thank you. Perfect. I'll let Bob know tomorrow. But yes, yeah, so you have to, you know, the choice of the mood, the music, how the whole thing works. You do have to keep some authenticity to the play. Otherwise, it just the story doesn't, as I say, hold the credence that it really needs.
Yeah, brilliant. So you're directing again for this one. You've directed quite a few now, haven't you?
It's the first full-length play I've directed.
First full-length?
Yes, right. So I've directed quite a few one-act plays in the one-act festival, sort of Madverse stuff and what have you. But this is the first full-length play I've directed. So I'm absolutely really enjoying it. So the cast are making it very easy. One thing I would say I find the hardest is the usual sort of service players. Not many people at rehearsals all the time.
Yeah,
but we're 3 weeks away now, and you know we are. Yeah, we've managed to get some really good full runs in, and I'm really really pleased with how it's going. The way that I direct is links quite closely to what John was saying in terms of creating moments. I like to be able to create a view on stage And it's all about how we get to that view on the stage. And I think I like to think very much about what the audience might be thinking or feeling at the time when this is happening. And then so the direction sort of comes from that, really.
Great.
Audience-led direction. There you go, that's a new phrase.
Yeah. So when does the directing stop, John? Does it end at the end of rehearsal?
I get my notes in the car on the way home. I think one of the things with doing this, with such a big part, I know the other side of it is quite good, is it gives, there are some smaller roles which are people that perhaps don't want, and we've actually found with a lot of people that are really keen to be involved but might not want to have a speaking role.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of other roles on the stage which allow you to do that and interact. And when you get the audience on the stage, you need others to come and, let's say, just marshal the jewellery and get them into the right place, making sure they've got everything that they need for their bits, and then getting them on and off again, health and safety and all the rest of it. But it gives people a role, and so many props that need to be in the right place at the right time, so someone else has to be in charge of that. But it's an amazing, and all these things that then go unsung but are just as important.
Yeah, and there's the court clerks, and there's the stenographer, and all those different people.
Absolutely, and we have all of those people. And as John says, you know, we have a lovely lady, Liz Parks, who just wanted to be in it, so she's our stenographer, and she's whizzed off and hired a stenography machine for us, and what have you. Very, very enthusiastic. But you know, the great thing about, as you know yourself, about any of these sort of productions is the tremendous amount of teamwork that you get from everybody. And yes, some of it might be a bit last minute, but if, you know, everybody pulls together, because at the end of the day, all that anybody wants is to put something on the stage that people are going to come and enjoy. You know, if people don't come and see a production, then as much as we all might think we're great, might enjoy the rehearsal process, it's somewhat pointless, really. So.
I've been there. I've been in productions where there are more people on the stage than in the audience.
Well, I
you
think
still have to give it 110%.
Exactly. Oh gosh, yes.
I think we all have.
It's actually harder doing it for a smaller group of people. You've got fewer to please.
It is.
And everyone's watching.
Like hope. One man and his dog, and they even turned around and walked out.
Well, back in 2000, I think it was, or 2001, I did West Side Story with Manx Operatic Society. And obviously that's a real bums on seats kind of a show. And from Wednesday through to Saturday, it was full house. There were people as far as I could see, right the way up into the gods and everything as well. 8 weeks later, I did a play with the Alderney Theatre Group. We did 300 people over three nights. It was going from the fullest house you could possibly see to looking out and going, is there anybody there?
Hello! Hearing an echo coming back.
Almost want to invite them on the stage, give them a bit closer.
That's so frustrating with my chairman of Madfa hat on. You know, when we put on the Easter Festival plays and the one-act play festivals, you see some fantastic drama.
Mm.
And yet, you know, the audiences for straight plays and what have you are always smaller. And yet, you know, I would argue some of the best performances I've seen on the Gaiety stage have not been musicals. They've been the plays that people put on. But 'twas ever thus, really. You know, you have only have to look in the West End where, you know, the majority of things on are musicals, although, you know, there are some good plays now on that, you know, that are being staged, which is great. But as John says, you know, you still give as much as if you've got 10 people or 1,000 people.
Definitely. So how did you both get started then? What was it that got you into theatre in the first place?
Me, I got into theatre because I wanted to meet boys. I went to
David Artis has the same story about meeting girls.
Yeah, so I went to an all-girls school back home in Gloucester, and the only way that we got to meet boys was to go and be in joint school productions. So that's how I got involved in theatre.
Mm-hmm. John, how about you?
I was more coming from a musical background. So I, after being told at 5, 6 that I couldn't sing, ended up in the choir when I moved over to the island. And then I got a role in a musical and, need to act. So then started, so I did, it was a role, a sailor, I can't remember what it was. I think it was a sailor in a version of Sweeney Todd.
Oh, right.
And then I ended up then having to go to Zoe McCandry as a drama teacher to learn how to act and build my confidence on the stage.
Was it Anthony? Was that the role, Anthony?
I honestly cannot remember.
Sort of the young sort of romantic lead.
It could have been.
Yes.
I don't even know what version of Sweeney Todd this was. It wasn't the original, the proper one.
Yeah.
But it was. I thought it was all right. Went okay. But then you got the bug, and as the years gone on, then I actually moved away from doing musicals into then just doing drama, and that's what I much prefer now. And sort of found a love of acting more from the singing side, and then sort of put that to one side.
Yeah,
we're both. I think I've done far more plays than I've done musicals. I think for both of us, that's been our preference.
Yeah, I kind of switch back and forwards depending on what comes along and what I like
you
to
don't
do.
Care.
So,
yeah.
I think one helps the other, you know. Sort of, yeah.
It does. And it's interesting. It's great when people have that view. You know, I know there are some people who will just do musicals and nothing else. But I like. I think plays are far more challenging in terms of getting your dramatic moments and pulling characters out and really convincing an audience.
Mm.
So. Sometimes I find with musical theatre, and this is not, there are some good ones. I remember having a good chat with one of your previous guests about how you can get musicals which are set up where the songs help the story and drive the story forward, and there are other ones which, oh, we'll have a break from the story now, or we just sing a song.
And then there's the third type, which is the jukebox, which basically the story is just an excuse to get to the next song.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what that's one of my problems with musicals, is that perhaps I've seen far too many of the ones where it's just the music is there incidentally to the story. Whereas with drama, it is all hard hitting. You build that tension and that suspense and push it through. Now I find it quite hard to try and think of what you'd actually, because you can call it straight drama, or you can just call it a play, or you can, whatever, but that's what we tend to prefer doing, and I like doing that more gritty side of things, rather than sort of pure comedies and things as much. That maybe just my skill set.
My favourite moment from any production I've been involved in was a one-act play that I wrote and directed in 2018 called The Perfect Gentleman, which was about John's great-grandfather's experiences in the First World War.
Yes.
And at the very end, we projected Cyril's image on a screen, and we had somebody reading out his last letter that he wrote to his son. And then we faded the lights down, and we had The Last Post played. And nobody clapped.
Wow.
We created such a moment that everybody was so just in that moment.
It was one of those, it felt or didn't feel right to applaud.
Yeah.
And we wondered, oh, something gone wrong. We stood backstage and thinking, oh, something's gone wrong. It's actually that.
And it's that sort of thing that I like to create on the stage.
Yeah. Fantastic.
The thing I always go for is if you've got an audience, they don't cough.
Yeah.
There's no shuffling.
There's
no crisp rattle at a packet or ice cream or anything like that. If you've got an audience in the palm of your hand, there's no noise. You can hear a pin drop in the audience, and that's what I go for, and try to get. I have had it on the Gaiety stage where someone's turned around and said, "Well, this is rubbish," to their friend while they sat next to that. But that's actually didn't do it that time. I can't remember what play that was. A few years ago.
I don't know. There was a play I came to see you in. I think would it be in the Yes Minister, maybe, where I had somebody sat next to me who was obviously such a massive fan of the TV series that they were saying the lines before the people on the stage were actually saying them.
Well, because that probably would have been me, because that's one of my all-time favourite comedy show, Yes Minister.
Yeah, I remember my father and Emma talks about it, her stepdad as well, absolutely roaring with laughter at it, and she's like, I don't understand it. But then obviously now we're coming back and you see repeats on the TV, like, oh, now I get it.
Absolutely.
So just we going back there, about having the audience in the palm of your hand and they're there and listening. A conversation with David Artis I had on a previous podcast when he talked about the pantomimes that he's written as well. And he always had this sort of hard and fast rule that, you know, the song that was in there had to have something to do with the story, and it was no more than 2 minutes long, because if it was longer than that, then you lose the audience, because certainly that you know, the part of the cast that has the that comedy sidekick, they come on and they go, their job is to rile the audience up. And then if you have a song that's all dreary and, you know, and a bit slow and goes on for a long time, and all the audience they're into the sweets and the crisps or whatever, then they've got to come back out.
When you've got young children.
Or looking at the phones, yes. That's the other thing.
One of the good things about the Gaiety is the internet.
Reception is awful.
Rubbish.
Yes.
One positive at least about the Gaiety. You know, you're going to get the audience at some point.
Yeah, right? They're never going to drift onto the phones at that rate, are they? No. Yeah.
You're listening to the Manx Theatre Podcast.
Okay, so what would you say are the favourite roles that you've played over the years?
Now, because you very kindly sent over some just to think about before we come on.
Yeah,
that's the hardest one of all of them to come for, to try and answer. The role that springs to mind, the hardest role I've had, is the one when we did Perfect Gentlemen. That was the hardest role to try and do, but the one I felt,
especially had that emotional link to it as well.
The family connection as well, and the way in which, but it was 9 letters, all of which are about 5 minutes or 3 or 4 minutes long.
Yeah,
solid text with no prompt and no assistance. And if you caught anyone's eye in the audience, that's it, you've gone. No prompt. But the one I think is actually the play that in which we first met, which was when I did Flare Path, which was 10 years ago this year.
Right,
the Gaiety Service Players. And you were coming back to the point you made before about people not coming to see it.
Yeah.
I would say that's one of the Service Players productions, which I would say it's one of the best ones.
Mm-hmm.
But and it's an unknown, relatively unknown Terence Rattigan play about a pilot who, and I played the guy Teddy Graham, gets shell shock. But when it was written in 1942, it was first performed during the Blitz.
Wow.
And Terence Rattigan flew off. He got writer's block. And was then sent off to Africa through Second World War way of curing writer's block by his psychiatrist to try and cure it.
Yeah, so he get some experience.
He was,
yeah,
so he was a flight. So he went to joined up as a pacifist.
Yeah,
joined the RAF, flew off to Africa, and he started writing Flare Path while he cured him.
Right.
In sense of his writer's block,
he
got the story, and they would stop performances midway through because bombs are falling on the theatre and around the theatre in London. There's air raid going off. But to write about something like that during the Second World War, it was brought back a few years. Mike Hoy directed it.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic production. And I felt really sad that there wasn't as many audience members to come and see it.
Yeah,
I'd love to do that play again, but unfortunately I'm probably a bit old now to be playing Teddy.
Yeah.
Give it 20 role. Years and it's 2042.
Absolutely, absolutely. For me, one of my favourite roles was where I met one of my lifelong friends, actually. So way, 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 way back again, before I moved to the Isle of Man, I was involved in the production of Into the Woods in Woking. I played one of the Ugly Sisters, and it was one of the hardest things I've had to do. You know, you probably know yourself, if you're in a Sondheim, you literally have to count from the minute the music starts to the end of it, otherwise you just...
And Into the Woods is crazy as well.
Off, so... But the lady who was playing the baker's wife was Carrie Hunt.
Oh, right, yes.
So we were both... living down in the south of England, did this production and then parted ways. And then years later, I was looking to buy a house down in the south of the Isle of Man, and this lady came in to show us around the house, and we were sort of sizing each other up like, don't I know you from somewhere? And then all of a sudden, Carrie said, weren't you in Into the Woods? So in 1990 or something like that, whenever it was. And I went, yeah. And so, yes, our friendship reignited from that. And she's obviously, she's a very dear friend.
Yeah.
But the production itself was hard. And I think, again, you know, if you go and do something that's easy, then, yes, it's easy and you can look fantastic at it. But if you actually challenge yourself, I think quite often that's when you get your best performances.
Brilliant.
Mom and I didn't have a complete emotional breakdown in the middle of the Flare Path.
Yeah, she
that
hadn't.
Was enjoyable.
Yeah.
Every night.
Craggy. Okay, so how about the dream role then? What's the one role, or what's the role that's at the top of the bucket list that you've just got to play at some point?
So it's interesting, as I've done more directing, I think my days of performing on the stage is sort of dwindling away now. But there is a production of Cabaret that's on at the moment in the West End, and John and I were very, very lucky to go and see when it first came out with Eddie Redmayne in it and Jesse Buckley. And if I had limitless talent, I would love to play the MC role, because I went to see it again for a second time, and there was a lady actually playing. I see it as a very androgynous role. Mm.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Particularly in that production, that would be a fantastic role to play.
Yeah, fantastic. John, what about you?
It was a part that I saw. He'd been in a service play. It's called Daniel Keane. He did it when I saw him at school, when he did it as Salieri in Amadeus.
Right.
That is my ultimate role. That if I could, I'm too young for it at the minute, but it's one that getting to that point that I would. That is the one role, and I've said several times, if I could play that role, that's it. I'd walk away, and if I never did another theatrical role again, I'd be happy.
Job done. Thank you very much.
It's also massive. It's just a huge, huge role. But it's a dramatic, very dramatic role, with amazing music. And the National Theatre did a production a few years ago where they had orchestra and it was on a rotating stage. That'd be it for me.
Okay. Flipping that question on its head then, is there a role in a newer show or play or whatever that's come out that you would love to play but you are now too old to play?
Well, there are lots of those for me, I think. Now that's quite easy, but what a few.
Right, come on then, you say.
No,
I'm down, I need to have a think.
What you're thinking, for me, there are shows like Dear Evan Hansen. I'd love to have played Evan Hansen, but at 45, I am at least 25 years too old for that part. Although I think he was about 28 in the movie version of it, but still.
It's a difficult thing. It's interesting. We have to confess, we don't see an awful lot of new musicals, but we see a lot of new plays. Mm-hmm. We've not long gone to see a production called The Motive and the Cue at the National, and somebody's playing Elizabeth Taylor in that role. Tuppence Middleton, is it?
Yeah.
That she played that would be a fantastic role to play. So it's all about... when Richard Burton played Hamlet in New York, and Sir John Gielgud directing him, and Mark Gatiss plays Sir John Gielgud.
Johnny Flynn, when he does, so there's a part in that where he does the speech, to be or not to be speech, and you know I talked about pin drops.
Yeah,
there was something you could feel it in the audience when he starts to do to be or not to be. After all of his other bits, and because
plays a drunk most of the way through,
and then he gets
it?
To that, and suddenly, bang!
Yeah,
he is an actor, and he's captured the moment, because it's supposed to then capture the moment where, because he can't get Hamlet all the way through the production, and suddenly, he finds his Hamlet.
Yeah,
and it just takes over, and the audience.
There's an electricity in the air. It's just
and the whole production of it was fantastic. It was directed by Sam Mendes. It's just about to go into the West End.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way that they did the scene changes is, rather than the curtains coming in as they would normally do, either down or across, it had them coming in like a camera shutter lens. It was very, very clever. Very clever. So I've given you enough time to think about it now.
I'm too involved in that now.
Balcomine and Kingscote Theatre, they both have a great season of the National Theatre and the RSC production. So hopefully that'll come up in the near future then on one of those screenings. We can all get a chance to see that as well.
Whether I am too old for it, but Henry V would be something I'd love to give a go to.
Yeah.
Even though Shakespeare is hard to learn.
What about that production of Hamlet we saw with Andrew Scott in? That was fantastic.
Yeah, but in terms of being too old for a role.
That's the problem. You see, you're still a chicken. So.
Ian McKellen playing Hamlet at how old? 84.
We've just seen him actually in a new production called Frank and Percy with Roger Allen.
Yes, I've heard about that.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. Really, really good. Lots of new plays, but we tend not to do too many musicals, do we?
Yes, so Ian McKellen, the oldest student ever.
Yes. And of course, the biggest problem, and I'm sure lots of your other guests have come on and said this as well, is that you know, a lot of the productions that we've talked about today, there are lots and lots of fantastically strong male characters and these things, but not too many strong female characters, and that always is, you know, quite tricky.
But it does seem to be changing, though, doesn't it? I mean, there's some of the newer stuff. There seems to be lots more sort of strong female leads, and a lot of the newer productions are all sort of changing sexes of some of the characters as well.
There was
an RSC production of Twelfth Night a few years ago, which had Tamsin Gregg as Benvolio,
rather
than Benvolio. So I mean, that
and
was
we actually time. In even in our play, we have some of our male roles are played by ladies as well. So yes, that is true. But as I say, it does make it quite tricky sometimes.
And Maxine Peake quite famously played as well, didn't she? Yes,
that's what I mean. In terms of if I were trying to play a female role, I mean, if you move beyond, if we're trying to stick to the drama that we talk about, that we were talking about there, you look at something like Blanche from Streetcar Named Desire, or Hedda Gabler, which is often described as the female Hamlet. It's such an enormous role to try and play. But again, it comes down to what talent. We talked about limitless talent before, I think. Ugly Sister for me. Although you said I'm banned from ever playing a woman again on stage.
You were too pretty.
Yeah, you had to keep making me pretty. Of course, the pantomime. You had to stick more and more fake hair and moles.
You had this gorgeous, great big blonde wig, curly wig on. Yeah. And of course, John's torso has fantastically long legs and what have you. It just looked
The hair wasn't.
Too pretty, I think that was somewhat the problem.
Yeti in the leg.
We needed to put your fat suit on you or something, would have been better.
Okay, with that in mind then, what are the best and or worst costumes that you've ever worn?
Well, we got to go back to, I remember did a going back to school again, house plays.
Yeah.
Where they are, there was one where I was trying to be, I was flung around the stage. It was a man dressed as a woman playing a man playing a woman. And those ludicrous roles. It was a play within a play trying to do Shakespeare, and had the worst wig I think anyone had ever seen, where it was missing half the hair. There was the netting showing.
Yeah.
This really horrible leopard print costume and ripped tights, and see me with big booming bass voice trying to fit it. Awful.
Sounds wonderful. Was that King Bill's or was that?
It might have been, yes.
Yeah. Just with the house plays, yeah.
Yeah.
Sharon?
Indeed. So I suppose for me, I don't know, I'm always one for a slightly interesting costume. I remember doing Witches of Eastwick and having these lovely sort of floral culottes as my main costume, which were particularly disgusting. But I think probably the worst costume for me was I was playing a sprite in a panto, so a silver unitard with a sort of diaphanous star over the top of it was not great. But my favourite costume of all time is when we did Blackadder, and I was playing Nursey, and we got the costumes from the TV show.
Oh,
so
wow.
I got to wear the actual Nursey costume.
Wow, that's brilliant.
They made
the other costume.
And I was about to say, the piece de resistance for me was that I actually had my own udder costume for the fancy dress, which I still have at home.
Oh, that was the most ludicrous conversation in our marriage. When we were clearing out our old house, moving to our new house now, and said, should I keep the udder costume?
Of course.
When on earth are you ever going to wear
well,
not the point.
Why not? You never know.
Break it out at a party.
That comes on to another, you know, classic incident of the audience not knowing what was going on. Beth Davis was playing Queenie.
Yeah.
And we had this sort of fancy dress scene in the play. And we were about two or three scenes before that, and we were waiting to go on. And in that scene for the fancy dress scene, Queenie goes on as her father, Henry VIII. So Beth rocks up side stage in her Henry VIII costume. We're all in our normal costumes, and I'm like, "What are you doing in that?" And all you heard was
beep, 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 beep,
beep, beep, beep, beep, beep, beep. Run off stage. Poor old Hammond's doing his Blackadder bit. Had to sort of eke it out a bit because she's trying, and obviously
Kane trying to eke something out on stage.
No,
and but of course, you know, getting from a Henry VIII costume to a Queenie costume is not a 2 second thing.
So she has seen ahead of herself, was she then?
She was two scenes ahead of herself, I think.
You got a lot of knitting done.
I got a lot of knitting done. Yes,
you sat on the stage knitting away, waiting for Beth to turn up.
Yeah, but that was would have been my favourite costume with the ruff, and I had fake boobs and a fake bum to make myself as big as Queenie was.
So John, your suit?
Back to Arbery Players.
What is your favourite costume? Been your suit?
Oh, favourite costume?
Yeah.
Well, it's going to have to be, isn't it?
It comes out in every single play, the
rather fetching white long johns that I had playing Jesus. That was quite.
See, now when you talk
outfit.
About having, you know, large roles and what have you, I always say to John, he's already played the biggest gig he's ever going to have because he's played Jesus being crucified on a cross.
Yeah. But you were saying about about plays, things that the audience didn't notice. I remember we did play with Arbery Players in Ballabeg Town Hall. That was the production where we had 6 people in the audience,
right.
4 people on the stage. It was a play within a play, and we got about 2/3 of the way through the production, and there was a word. I was supposed to say one word at one point, and then that would completely change the meaning of what then happened next.
Yeah.
So I said the word, and then carried on, and then we came back to it at the end. And there was supposed to be at the very end of the first act. I was supposed to then say a different word. I said the same word again, and then no one knew how to stop it.
Yeah.
And the first act ended up being 1.75 hours long. And it came round to the second time round, just as I was about to go on, everyone grabbed me and said, whatever you do, do not say that. Just say the right word this time. Then went on, yes, and thankfully said the right word, and there was almost a gasp of hooray from the cast as we could then carry on.
Probably.
But no, the audience didn't notice. But in fact, it was 1.75 hours, 6 people in. Oof.
Asleep.
Just going back to Sondheim, what you were saying there earlier on about the way that Sondheim writes. Back in 2004, was the first time that Manx Operatic Society did Sweeney Todd, and I was in that production and I played Tobias. Now, in the first half, Tobias is the apprentice to Pirelli, the Italian barber, and he's selling this wonderful miracle hair elixir. And there's a song that goes with that, and it's brilliant. And then in the second half, he's then working for Mrs. Lovett in the pie shop, and has a song all about pies, to the exact same tune, slightly different key, but the exact same song. And there was one night I stood up there, and at the start of the song, first half is, ladies and gentlemen, can I attend you, please? And it goes on about hair. And the second half, it's all about pies. And this night I stood up there at the second half with the pie in hand and started the song from the first half and thought, oh no! And I looked at the people in front of me who went, that's the wrong song. And I went, I know it is. And I looked at the MD and went, I don't know. And I went, thanks. And then what felt like about 20 minutes later, I remembered the lines and carried on with the rest of the right song.
And that's always nothing what happens, right, isn't it?
When you're singing a solo on stage and you forget the words.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing to save you.
No. And Carol was in that night as well.
Of course she was. Of course she was. And, you know, as you've just alluded to there, whenever something goes wrong or you forget a line or what have you, it seems like it's an absolute eon before, you know, anybody intervenes or you remember your line or what have you.
See the fear in someone's
it's
eyes.
It's so hard, though.
When you've acted with someone for a while, you can see that look of...
Yeah.
That glaze over eyes,
I've
forgotten my line.
What's coming next?
About four or 5 years back in the One Act Festival, I was in a play with Howard and Beth and Helen McKenna. And the play was Is This Seat Taken?
Yeah.
And it's a husband and wife trying to put a bit of spice back into the marriage by going off and doing a bit of role play, but it keeps it keeps falling apart, and they start again and they start again and they start again. So there's a lot of repetition in there. And occasionally in rehearsals, Helen would be on the wrong one and she'd jump to the next one rather than the one that we were on. And we won the One Act Festival and we took it away to Barnsley for the all winners. And I'm sat there and I thought, she just jumped 4 pages. Is she going on to the next one? And for what felt like forever, I'm going, I'm mentally skimming through the through the script and going,
what's the next line?
Oh no, she is on the right one. Right, that's okay. And then I can carry on.
But then, it's my line. Oh, that's
right. But I was talking to some of the guys afterwards and they went, oh, we didn't notice, because unfortunately it came at a point where it was a bit of a sticky, okay. And it was like in that sort of like 2.5 seconds.
You had managed to flick through, hadn't it? Because I guess as time slows down, your brain's working at overdrive.
Yeah. Fortunately, managed to get rid of it.
On the other end of the scale, I remember going to see a play where people had obviously hadn't been so quick on their lines. And there was some, the guy introduced the play. He was the chairman of the society, and he had a very deep and booming voice and said, well, also I am the prompt, but hopefully you won't hear anything from me this evening. And then, you know, obviously that was just the death knell as far as that was concerned. And by the end of the play, he actually came out from the wings and he gave a bow because the audience had heard so much from him as they had done from the actual cast on the stage. And there was a point where, you know, he was getting the round of applause as well. Yeah.
There's a professional production I saw in Cardiff. It's a Welsh National Opera where Carmen, guess a spoiler, dies at the end. Everyth dies of consumption, they all do in opera. And she died in front of the curtain.
Oh dear.
So just you get to the very end and everything, you see her, she's professional, but she's crawling underneath, back under the
curtain.
There's
nothing worse than that when you have a big dramatic moment where somebody dies,
and
then the lights don't go out and they have to get up and walk off the stage. It just looks awful, I think.
That's the play that goes wrong sort of thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and there's a lot of things these days where, you know, a lot of people tend to bring in the set changes. You know, the stage crew will be dressed in costume with, and, you know, so that it'll happen in the light or in a half light. So it just seems like it's part of the whole thing. And then, yeah, that's the kind of like...
Well, the difficulty with one of the reasons you do that is because you lose a lot of the pace of the production
if you have
that break, particularly with a fast production, like a farce or something.
Yeah.
Well, Mighty Governors,
yes,
for example. You lose that pace. And once you've got the audience, you've got to keep that pace going, the attention span of the audience. And if it dips too much, then you've got to try and build it up again before it then kind of moves on.
Yeah. Right, okay. So back in 2020, after the first lockdown, Neil King and I, we set up a musical theatre playlist. This was going to be our ultimate musical theatre playlist. Neil and I put 10 songs each into the playlist to get it going, because who wants to listen to a playlist with 2 songs? No one. Mm-hmm. And then every guest that's been on the podcast since then has added a song to the playlist themselves. Now, these songs are songs that have been in shows that they've been in, that they've performed. They're from their favourite show, or it's something that means something special to them. Like, for instance, Seasons of Love was sung by a group of friends at mine and my wife's wedding. So that's one of the reasons why that's in the list for me. So, Sharon and John, what songs would you like to add and why?
Should I think we've come up with a joint song.
Oh, a joint song.
Okay. We're only having one.
Well, it's up to you. I'm saying we've come up with a joint song. I've picked our joint song, if that's the case. But if you have a song... So our song is Never Mind the Why and Wherefore from HMS Pinafore, for a couple of reasons. So you'll remember I told you that the reason I got into theatre was because I wanted to meet boys. And so back in ye olden days, in the 1980s, as my children would call them, I used to do a lot of GNS shows with the local boys' school, and HMS Pinafore was one of them. And actually, this particular song, I think, is quite interesting, because when you listen to the rules, to the words, there's a lot of relevance in what they say today about you should be able to be free to marry whoever you love.
Yeah.
And John and I, it was one of the songs we had played at our wedding when we signed our register in London.
Well, it's what got me. So one of the things, reasons I got into acting, was because my mum did Gilbert and Sullivan Cross, and then encouraged me to then start acting. So she was always, never had a leading role, did GNS for 25 years, always in the chorus, loved every single show, and would always go and see whatever was on at the Gaiety.
Yeah.
So it was what got me into acting, with Gilbert and Sullivan. We went to see some production of it, Les Dennis.
Yeah, we saw HMS Pinafore last year. They, you know, usually do a GNS as part of their season.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because, I know that GNS has a reputation for being terribly dated and what have you. It was one of the sort of first productions I saw when I moved to the island in 1994. I think it might have been a production of Carousel, maybe, or Oklahoma. But that can't have been either of those because neither of those are GNS. That makes absolutely no sense. Probably Mikado or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's just that, I think that they are very well written. They were obviously political writings of the day.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, if you look at some of the writing, they are actually...
Very cleverly written, aren't they? Yeah.
But they are the types of productions that you could absolutely modernise.
Oh, yeah, and very easily, yeah.
And bring into the modern day.
So we saw a production of Iolanthe, which is about lords and ladies and fairies, and they played up to the idea. So all the fairies were in their 60s.
Yeah.
Middle-aged ladies. So it's all with little, big wings.
Little fairies, and then they've had politicians of the House of Lords, and they had Boris, someone dressed up as Boris, someone dressed up as Draco Rees-Mogg, and someone else, who else it was. But Priti Patel, I think it was one of the others.
Yeah.
But it was creating caricatures of the people, of the government of the day.
Yeah.
And that's the way it should be done.
Yeah, and I've seen a few Doyley Carte productions as well where they've put it sort of up to date. And also, I remember sort of back early 2000s, Sue Bowring, when she was still on the island,
mm-hmm.
Her showing me some productions by a guy called Simon Gallagher in mm-hmm. Australia. And he'd done three big sort of fairly modern productions of, I think it was Pirates, Pinafore and The Mikado.
Yeah.
And this, the captain in Pinafore normally is a tenor, but there's this big booming bass playing this part. And it just, singing Fair Moon to Thee, it was just a different song.
That's one of the great things about GNS shows is they are fantastic chorus shows. So if you do have people like John's mum who want to be involved in a show but don't want to be the leading light or what have you, and just want to have a good sing and entertain, then they are fantastic for that. Mm.
And I've done the Hot Mikado twice.
Yes.
Which is sort of
a
jazzed up version. Yeah, it was my very first musical with the Manx Operatic Society back in 1999. And I played, I was just one of the gentlemen of Japan, part of the chorus. And then in 2010, I think it was, they did it again. And I played Coco that time. Mm. So much fun as the Lord High Executioner. Mm. It was a very camp portrayal.
Yeah,
but they are all those characters in those in the GNS musicals are all fantastic parts to play. I think I just think again when I first came to the island, they used to be used to do GNS. It's a shame that people feel the need.
It would be nice to do. I know that we don't. People don't do them over here anymore. It'd be nice to do one every now and again. And even if it is Pirates or Pinafore, the two big two, that it's something that the songs are great, get everyone involved. Part that I'm too young for is the modern Major General.
You can always age you up, though.
Oh, crikey.
Makeup and some wigs and some big whiskers.
Me. Yes.
Oh, my word. So I started off as, what's it, Wilson?
You played Wilson, so the John Le Mesurier part. And they aged John up every night. And by the Saturday night, Jude, I think, had got a bit enthusiastic. He looked like he was just about to be buried.
I'd been dug up. Yeah. I was then buried. I started off at 60, went to 80. And then, the last night, I've been dug up for the production. That was a great show.
There's
so many fantastic productions the service players have done. I think all we can do with the current one that we're looking to went to the prosecution is that if we can sort of maintain that tradition and keep that going for another.
And do you know what? Emulate people like Auntie Jean.
Yeah.
And people like your mother-in-law, Carol. So Carol was the director of the first play that I did with service players. Daisy Pulls It Off. If we are anywhere near as good as those ladies, then I will be very, very proud to be following in their footsteps.
Fantastic. Right, well, Witness for the Prosecution then is playing at the Gaiety Theatre from the 9th to the 11th of November with nightly performances at 7:30 p.m. If you've not done so already, please make sure you go and get your tickets from villagaiety.com or by calling 600 555 and be quick about it because you've not got long left to go. Sharon, John, thanks for joining me on the Manx Theatre Podcast. I wish you and everyone involved at the service players all the very best for Witness of the Prosecution.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Manx Theatre Podcast with Neil Cullen.
Right, let's have a little look forward to see what's coming up in the next few months. On Saturday, 4th of November at the Peel Centenary Centre, the Legion Players present A Theatre Supper. That's a performance of My Brilliant Divorce by Geraldine Aron and a two-course supper, all for just £20. That sounds like a great night out. Then, as we've just mentioned, it's the Service Players with Witness for the Prosecution from the 9th to the 11th of November at the Gaiety Theatre. Getting us in the Christmas spirit early, Centre Stage Productions bring us Elf the Musical at the Gaiety Theatre from the 25th of November to the 2nd of December. Then, just like that, it's Christmas, and Stage Ed are here with this year's Gaiety Theatre pantomime, Aladdin, running from the 16th to the 31st of December. Then, before we know it, we're into 2024, and Evita and Oliver are just round the corner from the DCU and the Manx Ops. Hopefully, we'll get a chance to talk to some of those on the podcast over the next couple of months. Well, with that, we bring episode 49 to a close. Thanks once again to Sharon and John for joining me on the podcast. We wish them and everyone involved with the Service Plays production of Witness for the Prosecution all the very best. Remember to go and book your tickets by visiting the Villa Gaiety box office, the Welcome Centre, villagaiety.com, or by calling 600 555. The next episode is our 50th, and I hope to bring you something special to celebrate. So make sure to like and follow our social media pages to get notifications of upcoming events and episodes. Don't forget to check out the Spotify playlist by searching for Manx Theatre Podcast, and that's all one word. There's over 80 tracks on there now, and over 5.5 hours of show tunes to satisfy your musical theatre needs. If you have any events that you'd like me to talk about or promote in a future episode, you can contact me through my social media accounts or by email to manxtheatrepodcast@gmail.com. All that remains is to say thanks for listening, and I hope you join me again next time. I've been Neil Callan, and you've been listening to the Manx Theatre Podcast. Goodbye.
The Manx Theatre Podcast, taking a look behind the scenes of Manx Theatre.
Caviar than actors alive for me.